Hello there, listeners. Before we start, we have a little announcement to make. We are launching a new mini-series with our friends at the lovely magazine Are We Europe, and we are looking for your stories. The series is called This Is What a Generation Sounds Like, and we'll be recruiting 8 young storytellers who have a personal story that reflects on what it's like to be young in Europe right now. We have quite a vague definition of young, don't we?
Well, are we including ourselves in that definition?
Yes, we've created the boundaries just so we're within that definition.
Very convenient.
It's a paid project for 8 participants, and each person will come out with a beautifully produced visual podcast episode about their story, and they'll also get some training in podcast making along the way from our wonderful producers.
Getting paid to learn to make podcasts, what could be better?
If this project sounds like it might be something that's perfect for you or someone you know, then head to our website. There's a link in our show notes of the specific place on our website where you'll find it. Can't wait to hear from you. Now, time for the show.
Welcome back to The Europeans, which is now being recorded 100% in cities under curfew. We are stuck in the house, which I suppose leaves more time for podcasting, at least. Seems like the curfew's been much more controversial over there in the Netherlands than it has been here in France, Dominic.
Yeah, it's been quite a horrible few days, in fact, or a few nights, with riots in the street, people throwing fireworks at hospitals and setting cars and bikes on fire. Yeah.
It's awful.
Not fun.
It is obviously horrendous and entirely unjustifiable. But I am kind of intrigued about like why it's happening over there and not here, given like the long French tradition of setting fire to things.
Yeah, it is kind of surprising. You'd maybe expect Dutch people to sit around and have a chat about it and then get on with things.
Although I did ask on Twitter, and it started this quite, not funny, but grim argument about like who has a better and longer tradition of setting fire to things and rioting, which was entertaining, but quite dark.
Well, it's felt pretty bleak in the Netherlands the last few days. So let's talk about something else this week. What are we covering on the show this week, Katie?
We have a great interview coming up with the Dutch theatre maker Anouk Nijens, one half of the duo behind a remarkable play about climate change. Anouk and her writing partner, Rebecca de Witt, spent months and months and months studying Shell, the Dutch-British oil company. They went to shareholder meetings of Shell, they pulled through documents, and they used all of this material as the basis for a play about climate change and about how no one really wants to take responsibility for it. Something that they apparently demonstrated with devastating effect using the power of theatre. The play has been kicking up a storm in the Netherlands, and it's pretty clear that it's destined for similar success internationally. So this week we are getting the inside scoop about how it all came about. So that is coming up a little bit later. But first, it's the continent's favourite podcast segment.
Who's had a good week, Katie?
Okay, so hear me out. I am giving good week to the Russian opposition movement. And I know that might sound crazy in a week when thousands of Russian opposition activists got arrested. But I do think there's a little glimmer of hope in there, and that is something that we need to cling to in these rather dark times. But to talk about what happened over the weekend, we probably need to rewind a bit to the weekend before last, which saw the arrest of one specific opponent of Vladimir Putin, Alexei Navalny, hugely famous anti-corruption campaigner, and kind of the closest thing that Russia has to an actual opposition leader. Navalny was arrested at the airport in Moscow, having just flown in from Berlin. He had, of course, spent several months in Germany recovering from a frankly terrifying attack with Novichok, a Soviet-era poison. Navalny nearly died in that attack, and ever since, he has maintained that it was ordered by Putin. Putin has denied that, obviously, but Western governments are pretty sure that the government was behind it. So that's the background. Navalny flies back into Russia, immediately gets arrested, and he calls for people to take to the streets and protest against his arrest, which they did this weekend, tens of thousands of people.
So I've been watching these images of him like on the plane coming back with his family, and I couldn't help but ask, why? Why did he come back? He knew he was going to be arrested.
Yeah, it seems kind of insane, I think, to most people who dislike danger. I mean, he's made it pretty clear that he thinks he can't be an effective opponent to Putin from abroad. Russian opposition activists just kind of become irrelevant when they go into exile. No one really listens to them. And he obviously knew he'd be going straight to prison when he got home. He's facing embezzlement charges at the moment. So yeah, he knew he was going to prison, and he's not especially scared of prison. He spent a bunch of time there already. Some experts think that Putin is worried that keeping Navalny in prison could make him more dangerous because it makes him more of a martyr figure. So maybe Navalny is making some bet that he might get it out. It's kind of unclear right now. But there's a big hearing on February the 2nd. So I guess we'll get a better idea then of whether he's going to stay behind bars or not. And that will probably shape what happens next.
So I didn't think this was a good idea to make this Good Week because I don't understand how you could see this as Good Week. Yeah, I mean, it's good to see people coming out protesting, but they were all arrested. There doesn't seem to be any plan. And it wasn't enough people to make it actually any difference. And Navalny is actually still quite unpopular, according to opinion polls in Russia. Has he got a plan?
Yeah, I agree that that is kind of unclear right now. But I would argue that it does feel like he is entering some kind of end game to the struggle with Putin. Like, he's gone all in, you know? So just after he got back, Navalny's team released this absolutely massive investigation on his YouTube channel. It's the kind of video that made Navalny famous in the first place. For years, he's released these YouTube videos exposing the corrupt ways in which the Russian elite have earned their wealth. And they've just released a new video, which is about Putin himself and about this absolutely mind-blowingly luxurious property on the Black Sea that Putin allegedly owns. It's supposed to have cost something like $1.4 billion to build. I don't even know how that's possible. It's got an underground ice rink, apparently. But yeah, the video about this insane property has gone huge. It's had like 80 million views at the time of recording. And the release of this video, like, it felt quite orchestrated. It looked like it took years to put together.
It's so slick.
It is, yeah. It's really slick. And it is also the most direct shot that Navalny has ever taken at Putin himself. His videos are usually about the people around Putin. So that felt to me kind of like a calculated move. Like, there's some kind of plan being executed by the opposition right now.
Yeah, but I mean, it kind of sadly reminds me a bit of Belarus, where just all these protesters were arrested and rounded up. And once they're in jail, what can happen?
Well, Belarus opposition movement is still going after how many days now? I've lost track. Yeah, it's true. So in Russia last weekend, loads and loads of people got arrested at these protests, about 3,500 people. And the policing in some places was very violent. There are these awful videos of cops like beating up protesters and people with blood running down their faces. But the reason I think that there is still a glimmer of hope in all of this is that these were the biggest protests against Putin in years. Like, tens of thousands of people came out across the country, 40,000 in Moscow alone. And people were braving these incredibly cold temperatures to join these protests. You could see all these videos and pictures of protesters with ice in their eyelashes. I think it was minus 52 Celsius in Siberia,
wow,
which is colder than my brain can like even comprehend. Yeah, so I think there's something inspiring in that, in people standing up to Putin and saying, this country is supposed to be a democracy and all you do is trample on it.
Okay, fine. I'm convinced that there's something inspiring about it, but long term, is there any danger for Putin losing any of his power?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone has any doubts that Putin has remade Russian institutions in such a way that it is incredibly difficult to dislodge him. He has changed the constitution so that he can be president till 2036. He has the media saying all of these amazing things about him around the clock. Like, how are you supposed to fight against that? But there are these little cracks coming in. So there's elections coming up in September. Putin's party have dropped to only about 30% support, which is historically low. And Navalny is urging massive tactical voting to try and lose as many seats for United Russia as possible. And I think even though this is a kind of David and Goliath situation, I do think Putin is scared of Navalny. As you said earlier, Dominic, like, lots of people haven't even heard of him. But more and more Russians now have heard of him, which is pretty impressive given the grip that state media has on people's access to information. And more people also approve of him. And especially young people, he's got this massive support base amongst young people, which I think is a good sign for the future. In the long, long term, I think Navalny knows that this could very easily end up with him dead. We've already seen that with the poisoning attack. And he and his extremely brave wife, Yulia, they've come home anyway to do whatever it takes to make life more difficult for Putin. And that, I think, is just astonishing courage.
Yeah, it sure is. It reminds me a bit of Maria Kolesnikova, one of the Belarusian protest leaders, who is still sitting in jail after having ripped up her passport instead of crossing the border. These people.
Who's had a bad week?
Before we start talking about bad week, do you think everyone knows what TikTok is by now?
Well, as we mentioned at the top of the show, Dominic, this is an extremely young podcast for young, cool people, so I think so, but do you want to tell us anyway?
I was actually going to ask you to explain it, because I feel like you know more about TikTok than me. I've never been on it.
Yeah, I went on TikTok just yesterday, actually. Hashtag relevant.
Ooh.
TikTok is an app where you can post very short videos, often of sexy dancing, but increasingly, there's like these weird DIY types of TikTok coming in. So my sister-in-law has got me quite into BrickTok. Do you know what BrickTok is?
No.
It's videos of people bricklaying, and it's very soothing. It's just people like smoothing cement over bricks. It's really nice.
Well, there are clearly lots of different types of TikTok, and there was a TikTok craze that's been going mad over the last few months of people singing sea shanties, and that was really nice, and it's been cheering people up during lockdown across the world. But there are some really dark corners of TikTok, and I'm afraid today we're going to be talking about one of them. It's a pretty terrible story, so feel free to skip ahead 2 minutes if you don't feel in the right headspace. Because it's been a bad week for TikTok in Italy. And there are some weeks when our chosen language of good week, bad week doesn't quite fit the moment. And yeah, this week is one of those weeks. Bad doesn't even vaguely describe what happened in Italy, where a 10-year-old girl in Palermo died from what is thought to be accidental asphyxiation, because according to her younger sister, she had been taking part in a blackout challenge on TikTok. It's a horrible, tragic story, and I'm actually not going to go into more details about her death. The details are gruesome, and the investigation around the circumstances are still ongoing. But it obviously raises a lot of questions about TikTok's responsibility for the children who are using their app.
How old do you actually have to be legally on TikTok?
The app is actually only meant to be able to be accessed by children over the age of 13. Mm. And the fact that this 10-year-old child was able to access the app shows that clearly the policy wasn't being effectively policed. In fact, tragically, the Italian Data Protection Agency had already launched a lawsuit against TikTok in December, in which they criticized TikTok specifically for this, for having a system which children under 13 could circumvent too easily. They also criticized them for privacy regulations and general protection of minors, but they highlighted this point, and clearly something needs to be done immediately to stop children under 13 accessing the site and to ensure that no more children are exposed to this potentially dangerous material on their site. The Italian Data Protection Agency pretty much immediately announced that they were forcing TikTok to ban anyone from their app whose age could not be definitively verified. This has meant that for many users in Italy this week, the app has gone down. And it's a good first step, but it doesn't solve the problem of the fact that dangerous content is being posted on the app, also for kids and adults over the age of 13.
So this obviously isn't the first time that harmful content has been found on TikTok, right?
No, nor is TikTok the only social media service that hosts some harmful content that incites people to do dangerous things.
Mm.
And content moderation on these platforms is a complex and rapidly evolving thing. But there have been a few particularly alarming stories from TikTok lately. In December, they launched an investigation into pro-anorexia and pro-starvation content, which, according to a Guardian report, was still managing to avoid the site's moderators. So there's still clearly a lot of work that needs to be done to make TikTok safer. And this is before we even talk about the allegations of insufficient privacy and security protections for users of TikTok. That's a huge topic which is already being investigated by multiple European countries and the EU-wide privacy regulator. But this week's tragic TikTok-related news is certainly going to add to concern about TikTok in Europe. And in fact, we're going to come back to this topic next week with an interview with an expert about big tech in Europe.
We have four wonderful new supporters to thank for this podcast. As you probably know by now, because we never shut up about it, this podcast is made possible by you, the listeners. It takes us a disturbing amount of time to put it together each week, so we are tremendously grateful to the latest people chipping in a few bucks a month to help us pay for it. They are Peter Solecki, Attila, Leotard, and Antal Janos Minori. Thank you guys so much.
If you'd like to join them and help support us and keep us going, then please head to patreon.com/Europeans podcast. We'd be ever so grateful.
By the way, looks like we got to the bottom of the how to pronounce Patreon mystery. A well-informed source, aka one of our Patreon supporters, Britta, I think she worked with the company for a bit, and she reliably informs us that it is Patreon, not Patreon. So no need to lie awake thinking about it anymore, Dominic.
Phew. In December, a huge civil court case opened in the Netherlands with 17,000 Dutch citizens, led by the Friends of the Earth, suing the enormous transnational gas and oil company Royal Dutch Shell, which, as Katie mentioned, is actually also British as well as Dutch. And it's a pretty huge company. In fact, it was the fifth biggest company, according to its revenues in 2020, in the entire world.
Wow.
And the largest in Europe. And yet, they ended 2020 in a pretty precarious position, facing a prolonged court case that could end up with them having to significantly reduce their CO2 emissions to put them in line with what was agreed in the Paris Agreement. This might sound like a far-fetched result for this case, but there has actually already been a very successful piece of climate litigation in the Netherlands against the Dutch state, which set a precedent by ruling that a failure to achieve climate goals is a human rights violation. So it could just happen. And someone who's been following and investigating the Shell case incredibly closely is Anouk Nijens. Anouk is a theatre maker and investigative journalist who has been researching Shell for a long time now, immersing herself in the world of this corporate beast. Anouk, along with theatre maker Rebecca De Witt, presented her research about Shell as a piece of theatre. And I actually got to see this play in person, can you believe it, during the brief moment when theatres were open here in the Netherlands, which feels like a very distant past now. I love the way Anouk thinks and works, and I'm so excited that she's agreed to talk to us and share some of her thoughts and findings on Shell and the climate crisis. Enjoy!
I don't think anyone's heard the words climate crisis and enjoy so close together. So, world first. So, Anouk, how did a theatre maker end up involved in a climate justice case against Shell?
Yeah, it started somewhere in 2017, together with Rebecca De Witt, who's also a theatre maker and a writer like myself. I made a performance which was based on the idea that the climate crisis is actually a crisis of imagination. A lot of scientists and thinkers are arguing that. But what we actually discovered during the making process of this performance is that the boundaries of our imaginations are the most stretched in courtrooms. We read about all these lawsuits worldwide where animals were given human rights. You have, for example, an orang-utan in Buenos Aires. Her name is Sandra, and she has human rights. There's also this river in New Zealand, the Wangzhou River, with human rights. And a lot of these stories started in a courtroom. And these lawsuits are stretching our imagination about the relationship between humans, animals, and our planet. And then we discovered this very revolutionary lawsuit against Shell. And in this case, they are sued, Shell is sued by a group of Dutch NGOs. And that's actually not so revolutionary, because Shell is being sued all the time, especially by NGOs. In this lawsuit, these NGOs are forcing Shell to stop causing global climate change. They demand a radical change from Shell. And this has not been the first time that people are trying to force companies like Shell for climate damage. But this one really made it to court. So that's very unique and therefore very special.
And are you involved directly in this case?
No, but when we started researching this case, we emailed, of course, Shell, but we also emailed Friends of the Earth. We have good contact actually with Friends of the Earth and with their lawyer. We can call them or, you know, etc. But Shell never answered, unfortunately. There are quite some Shell employees that watched our performance about them, but we never really got in contact with them.
Could you describe to our listeners what this show is trying to do?
Yeah, of course. Well, it's so first when we started, it was actually the idea to more or less represent the case. But then we discovered when we were researching deeper in this whole topic of the climate crisis that there were so much more parties involved actually in the question, yeah, who's responsible in the climate crisis. This lawsuit is especially about, is Shell responsible for the climate crisis? But of course, there's also the government. You also have the consumer, you have the citizen, you have future generations, you have the earth itself. And so we made for all these parties who are involved, we wrote a monologue. So what you see in the performance are actually six monologues. So Shell, the consumer, the government, the citizen, future generations, and the earth itself. And they are all arguing why they are not responsible or responsible for the climate crisis.
I work as a journalist, and I feel like what you're describing is not that dissimilar from what journalists do. You're trying to tell people about what is happening in the world that we live in. Why did you decide to present the story and all of this research as theatre rather than a kind of traditional piece of like written journalism or a documentary film?
More and more artists are involved in this topic, but it's also still a bit of unknown territory. And that's a pity, I think, because I think art can really play a big role in the very polarized debate on climate crisis. But another strong reason to choose for theatre is because we discovered so much theatricality in our research to Shell. Of course, like a lawsuit is very theatrical, but Shell also uses a lot of theatrical elements. For example, they have every year they have a shareholder meeting, and it's always in a theater. It's with the lights and a scenography. It's really theatrical, but they also have a scenario department. And at this department, there are a group of, I think, 30 very creative people work on possible future scenarios full time. For example, they worked on a scenario about the oil crisis during the 60s. That was then unthinkable because everybody thought the price of oil would continue to rise because the researchers were infinite. But Shell abandoned that assumption. And in one of their scenarios, they elaborated further on the consequences of an oil price drop. And when the price indeed fell, I think it was somewhere in the 70s, 1973, no one understood what was happening except for Shell. And as a result of that, they were extremely prepared. And yeah, it was a big advantage actually for them.
So this links back to your idea that the climate crisis is a failure of imagination and that in fact Shell have had that imagination.
Yeah.
They've had a team of creatives who are looking into the future.
Exactly.
Being paid full time to guess what might happen.
The funny thing is they had hundreds of scenarios, but another scenario they wrote in 1998, they predict a big climate lawsuit. Somewhere around 2010, it says in the scenario, there will be a summon in Shell's letterbox and Shell will be charged because Shell systematically ignores what scientists have been warning about for decades. So they are not surprised at all if in 2018, the summon ends up at their desk.
And then that scenario, like, how did it end? Did they win? Did they lose? Did it end up making them do more to protect the climate?
No, they don't. And they don't predict if they will win there are just a lot of strategies in this scenario, how they should deal with it.
And so going back to your play for a minute, one of the characters is a fictional version of the CEO of Shell. And he makes some actually quite confrontingly convincing arguments that by forcing Shell to do more for the climate through the courts, you're merely stifling one of the most green-minded energy companies out there in the world, and that more polluting companies like Exxon will benefit directly from Shell being regulated more. And I guess this is an argument that the scenario department created, but are you convinced by any of these arguments yourself? Is it something you worry about?
They are very good in rhetoric. So what we actually did, we did a research of 2 years or something to really get in touch with all these different voices in the debate. And what we did for this monologue for Shell, we read all the speeches from the 80s till now, where it was about climate change. And in these speeches, you see, of course, a lot of very smart rhetoric, like the best ones we put in. And of course, we rewrote it a bit. Also, we have a very brilliant actor who does it. And people are really, I sometimes see spectators are, the color of their skin is getting more and more white. And like, oh my God. So I see the fear in their eyes. But then, of course, you have also future generations who, in my eyes, kind of debunks a lot of the things that this CEO of Shell is saying.
As part of the process of researching and writing your play, you actually became a shareholder of Shell. Did you feel conflicted about giving them your money?
Not really, actually, if I have to be honest, because it's only 30 euros. And so that's nothing, because they have millions of shareholders, of course. And I bought it actually to enter their shareholding meeting, because if you have one share, you are allowed to enter their shareholding meeting in this great theater with this theater light and in this theater costumes. So I saw it more as a ticket for the theater that I bought. And besides that, I was a shareholder. I became a shareholder for this project, but I wasn't only a shareholder. I was also like a climate justice activist. I walked a lot in these climate demonstrations. I visited a lot of government meetings. So I changed in all kinds of roles.
But did having the share make you feel like you had any influence over the company at all?
No. I think I have more influence with my performance. And this is also, I get sometimes text messages from people from the fossil industry that they spoke somebody who works at Shell and they saw it. And I know that they talked about it and they know also that it is there. And I think that's my impact, I think, the performance. And I hope actually that they will, that way we will get to speak to them also, because a lot of people, when they hear, oh, it's a theater piece about Shell, they immediately think that we are activists, that we are very left, and because of that it's not interesting, and then they are very much conflicted and also surprised after seeing the show that it's actually not a piece of artivism. Activists were saying Shell must fall, but that we are really interested in all these different perspectives. In the show, there's a line that I'm saying that more and more have the idea that the climate crisis is actually a responsibility crisis.
Is there a way that we can learn from Shell's fiction and scenario building departments and use this method to help save the planet?
When we discovered it, we thought, actually, what a pity that there's no scenario department for citizens, where you can go to practice your lines and link through different scenarios about what kind of futures are ahead of us. And so we see also our performance kind of as a scenario department for citizens, where you can practice all the different roles in the climate debate. So developing scenarios is a way to deal with the insecurity of the future. It doesn't mean that you know what will happen. You can never be prepared for everything. But when we hit a crisis and you are already prepared, you have an advantage, because the power lies in hands of those people who know their lines best and wear their suits best and prepared in the best possible way. So my advice would be, learn from Shell and think more about the future.
I don't think I've ever been so excited about a play that I haven't seen yet, and I cannot wait for the Shell Case to come out in English, as I'm sure it will eventually, so watch this space. Since we're talking about the theatre, should we have a bit of isolation inspiration?
Yeah.
What have you been watching this week, Dominic? Or reading?
I've been watching season 4 of Call My Agent, or 10%.
Oh! me too.
Yeah.
So good.
It's another Paris-based Netflix drama that's a huge hit. What is happening? Why is Paris so key to all of Netflix's successes at the moment?
I don't know, but French TV is really having a moment. Like, obviously, French cinema has been huge for multiple centuries almost. But yeah, it's kind of the golden era of French television. It's making me feel very patriotic.
So this is the fourth and final season of a comedy drama series about an agency for French actors. And each episode has a different celebrity actor appearing as a kind of version of themselves. We've got Charlotte Gainsbourg in the first episode of season four. I have loved this show since I started watching it last March. I whizzed through the first three seasons at the beginning of March when the world was falling apart, and I find it the most calming, diverting TV, and the slightly over-the-top characters that work in this agency, I've become really attached to them. That said, I read a review on BBC News this week where they described it in such effusive terms, saying, if history judges this to be a golden age of television overflowing with magnificent creations and wonderful spectacle, then Call My Agent will be considered among the epoch's crown jewels.
Whoa.
I'm not sure. I think maybe that's taking it too far.
It's just it's a very funny show, but I don't know about that. It seems a bit much.
I think it's kind of really nice comfort viewing, but I don't think it's brilliant television.
Yeah, somebody got a bit carried away there.
But hey, maybe they're right. Maybe I'm being a snob and actually comfort viewing is what we need more than anything else. What have you been enjoying this week, Katie?
Also comfort viewing. I've got two lockdown movie suggestions for you. One old, one new. The newish one, which I enjoyed very much this weekend, was a film called Dating Amber. It's an Irish teen comedy from Amazon Prime. It's about two Irish teenagers, a girl and a boy, who realise that they are the only gay kids at their school. So they enter this kind of agreement to pretend that they're dating, just so that everyone leaves them in peace. And it's a very bittersweet, funny, at times slightly heartbreaking comedy about being gay in Ireland in the 90s. And it's got a really good soundtrack, really lovely sweeping vistas of the Irish countryside. What more could you want?
Sounds great.
And the other thing I really like about it is that it's kind of a friend romance. Is there a word for that?
In America, don't they call it like a buddy romance or something?
Yeah, I guess it's a buddy romance. That's a horrible expression. Fromance? I don't know. So that was really nice, Dating Amber. The other film that I watched was Moonstruck, 1987 rom-com starring Cher and Nicolas Cage. And it's about the various romantic relationships within this Italian-American family. Cher is really good in it, actually. She won an Oscar for it. Did you know that she had an Oscar?
Moonstruck is one of the best films of all time. And it's so interesting that it's like been having a moment during lockdown, because I became obsessed with this film about 2 years ago, and I've been showing it to everyone. I can't believe I haven't told you to watch it yet, because I think it's just one of the best films ever, and Nicolas Cage is so weird in it.
He's so ridiculous.
We are here to ruin ourselves and to break our hearts and love the wrong people and die. I mean that the storybooks are bullshit. Now I want you to come upstairs with me and get in my bed.
Cher is amazing. Yeah, she's a seriously good actor.
She's great. And it's just a very sweet and enjoyable film. It is very cheesy. It's got this very twee Italian soundtrack. It's quite hammy. I'd be curious to hear what our Italian listeners think about it, actually. But it is exactly the kind of film that I'm looking for on these long, long winter nights. And it definitely, definitely qualifies as a European recommendation because of its very tenuous Italian connection.
There have been all these think pieces written about Moonstruck and why it's been such a hit. There was one in the New Yorker and one in the New York Times over the last few months.
Really?
Yeah, I recommend you should dive into those as well, because it's quite interesting reading Cher also respond to its renaissance.
I had no idea it was going through one. I mean, I think it just came up on the front page, so I clicked on it. Well, there you are.
By the way, when I said buddy romance, that's completely made up. I just Googled it. Why did I think that?
Yeah, I'm Googling it too. It's not a thing, Dominic. But maybe it should be. There you go. Buddy romance.
Okay. I accidentally coined a new term. One final recommendation from me, which is that everyone should go out and buy Are We Europe's latest magazine. They have a colonialism issue, which recently came out, and it's packed full of fascinating articles and beautiful visuals. You can get 50% off this issue if you type the code EUROPEANS in at checkout. head to areweeurope.com.
Do it.
To close off this episode with some cheering news, Sweden are building bridges to help reindeers safely cross roads and railway lines.
I love it. My heart hurts just hearing those words.
Yeah, it's a lovely thing. Although, as you might have guessed, there are very sad climate apocalyptic reasons as to why these bridges are necessary and reindeer are straying further from their normal habitat due to global heating. But back with the happy for a second, they're calling them rainoducts, which are like viaducts, but for reindeers.
That's not really a pun, though, is it? There's a better pun out there.
Maybe it works better in Swedish. I don't know. But I think we should leave it there, because if I talk about it anymore, then you'll realise that it's actually a devastatingly sad story. Happy ending, reindeer bridges.
Yay.
I actually heard today that at one point the cliffs of Dover and the cliffs of Calais were connected, almost like a bridge. Did you know that?
I did not know that. As you will have heard at the top of the show, we are extremely excited about these new podcasts we're going to be making later in the year. This is what a generation sounds like. If there is a young person in your life who you think might be interested in telling a story about their corner of Europe and learning how to make a podcast and getting paid for it, please, please, please send them the link, which is in the show notes.
Thank you to Priyanka Shankar and Kat Laszlo for editing this week's show. We'll be back next week, but in the meantime, you can catch us on social media, Twitter at Europeans Pod, Instagram, Europeans Podcast, Facebook, The Europeans Podcast, and email us hello@europeanspodcast.com.
See you next week, everyone.
Bye.
Slán.